You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Ross Chast's cartoons began appearing in The New Yorker in 1978, and she's since published over 1,000 there. Richard Gere, the author of the book I Only Read It for the Cartoons, noted that Chast was considered, quote, the first subversive cartoonist at The New Yorker. Chast's muse and her beat is anxiety. A classic Chast cartoon, and I'm sure we all have our favorites, mine has a clown named Binky, shows a joyous man bursting into song, specifically the refrain of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, and the caption reads, In Deep Denial. And I know there are days when we all feel like we're living in a Ross Chast cartoon, which I think is a great compliment to Ross. Chast won the National Book Critics Circle Award for her autobiography for Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, her bold, honest, hilarious, and despairing graphic novel in which she described her interactions with her parents during their last years of their lives. And we have that book for sale tonight along with her new book. And as it turns out, cartoons are the perfect medium for describing old age, at least Ross Chast's cartoons are. They're also a great medium for describing pigeons, subways, water bugs, and pretty much everything in the universe. So let's give a warm Los Angeles welcome to that quintessential New Yorker, Ross Chast.
I can't believe there's so many people here. I swear, I thought like there were going to be like eight people or something. And I suggested that they put like a TV monitor over here so you could sort of watch the game as well as... Anyway, it's coming, it's coming, it's almost there. And we're going to bring down the lights a little bit also. And there it is. Okay, good. I'd like to start with this slide here. I'm not really much of a nature girl, to tell you the truth. I grew up in an apartment in Brooklyn, and I didn't really have a lot of experience with these elements, but I did have some. I took baths. I knew water. I had an air conditioner, not to brag. I knew air. Sometimes there was a situation with a toaster that resulted in fire. And sometimes my mother would decide that she was going to plant an avocado pit. And, you know, so there was earth. I'm going to show a few cartoons. This is Pigeon Little. The sky is falling. Oh, look, part of a bagel. This is the Fountain of Puberty. I don't know if you've ever watched kids coming out of a middle school, but it is really kind of a riot. This is when moms dance. You know, people sometimes ask me, where do you get your ideas for cartoons? And most of the time, I can't really tell you where I get my ideas, but this particular idea did come from life. My daughter was around 16 years old, and she was doing her homework in the living room. And if you have ever been a teenager or have raised teenagers, you know that there is nothing more disgusting in the eyes of a teenager than the sight of an adult human body. And if you really want to gild that lily, just do a little kind of dance, you know, like, yeah. And so she was listening to some hip-hop, and I started doing a little... Oh, by the way, could we bring the lights down a little more than this? Just a little more, please. I'm begging. Please, lights, dimmer. Dimmer. More, a little more. Please. We talked about this, please. All right. Thank you. That's good. So, anyway, she was in the living room, And I just wanted to see if she was paying attention. So I kind of came out, you know, dun, 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 dun. And she said, "Mom, stop, you're hurting me." And I said, "Could I use it as a line?" She said, "Okay." This is self-help books for the newly dead. We have 5 people you should avoid in heaven, eating for eternity, and who moved my urn? This is sort of self-explanatory. This is the not in the mood for human interaction line. This is too early to begin working on and too late to do anything about. Sort of sums up my life. This is gifts from the house of low goals. I can tell you where I got the idea for this one also. I was on the train and I saw this poster. It was for an advertisement for Carvel cake. And there was this little girl wearing these cute little cat's eye glasses. And she was surrounded by family and friends and a little hat on. And on the icing on the cake was written, "Congratulations on your new glasses." And I thought, as a civilization, we are doomed. I had T-shirts, "I survived conjunctivitis," "I can read a bus schedule," 100% human DNA, special occasion cakes, wow, only 6 cavities, happy tattoo removal, and no loitering rests in 1 year, cards, "I'm so glad you're not an arsonist," and "Congratulations on your new easy chair," and trophies, it's just participant. This is Urban Trail Mix. This is Insomnia Jeopardy. Ways in which people have wronged me. Strange noises. Diseases I probably have. Money troubles. Why did I say or do that? Ideas for a screenplay. I'm going to skip this one. This is Antiques, Collectibles, Bric-a-Brac, and Garden. I'm all right, folks. This is the freelance life. "Honey, I'm still home." And that brings me, I wanted to talk a little bit about process, my process. This is where I work. This is my desk. I work at home. I have a little studio at home. I, along with my 40 approximately fellow contract artists at the New Yorker, staff artists at the New Yorker, we submit every week a group of cartoons, which for some reason is called The Batch. And this batch contains anywhere from like maybe 5 to about 12 cartoons. It varies from person to person, from week to week. But it's not like we submit one cartoon and they buy it. We all submit a group of cartoons. So just to give you an idea of how many cartoons the New Yorker has to go through every week, let's just say 10, because I'm math challenged. It's 40 times 10 is 400. And another 400 come in from people who are not on staff, maybe even more than that. So that's, let's say, 800 cartoons, and that's probably a low estimate. 800 cartoons every week. These are winnowed down to about 100 cartoons, I submit mine. At this point, everybody submits them through cyberspace. This is a photograph of cartoons going through cyberspace. There are, back in the old days, people used to fax them in, or perhaps they brought them by carrier pigeon, I don't know, Shetland ponies with like bags of cartoons tied to their side. But at this point now, it's all PDFs and electronic submissions. And so you have these 800 cartoons that are being sent into the New Yorker. That gets winnowed down to about 100. And then they go to this art meeting where they buy about 20 to 25 every week. And I have never been to one of these art meetings, but I have always imagined that it looks a lot like this. The art meeting, there's David Remnick, and at this point we have a new cartoon editor, Emma Allen, And sometimes they invite a few other editors in there just so the taste isn't just two people. But the odds are so stacked against you. I certainly don't sell every week, and I do as well as anybody there, I think. But which is why if somebody says, my son, my daughter wants to be a cartoonist, you know, what should I tell them? I always say, if you can do anything else, you should do that thing. This is really for people who really can't do anything else. And I know I feel that way. And the cartoons that I don't sell go into a filing cabinet or filing cabinets in my studio, which are now full, and the cartoons pile up on top of the filing cabinets. And yes, I do sometimes resubmit them. This is not a big secret. Everybody does this. When I resubmit a cartoon, I write a little date when I submit it, so I know how many times I've resubmitted it. I usually rework it in some way, because if I really love a cartoon, I feel like if I just kind of put a, you know, comb her hair a slightly different way, or like put a bow on top, you know, they'll suddenly see its charms, you know. And I'll submit it about 4 or 5 times if I'm in love with it or something. And then after that, I don't want them to, you know, take me away or, you know, say, well, there's something really wrong with her here. It's been turned down 5 times. So I'm going to show a few cartoons and then talk about some other stuff. This is In a Just World. I don't know if you can read it over there. This is from the Tournament of Neurosis Parade. I never really broke away from my parents' float. The people who have difficulty forming bonds of intimacy with other people float. The hypochondria float. The in my mind's eye, I will always be a fat, short, frizzy-haired, glasses and braces wearing sixth grader float. It's for me. I only want what is unattainable float, and the fear of chickens float. And that sort of brings me to talk a little bit. I wanted to talk a little bit about the book I wrote about my parents, their last few years of their lives, about their relationship with each other, their relationship with me, called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? When I grew up, I heard these crazy stories. They were so wacky, and these were all apparently true. Friend's husband killed by falling flower pot. Friend nearly blinded by mascara causing infection. Friend who traveled too much, jaundice. A rash then dead, a headache then dead, a lump then dead. He was too happy. He jumped off a chair and broke his metatarsal. A guy who almost died after playing the oboe. Friend's son killed by baseball. I heard these stories. I was not allowed to sit directly on the ground when I was a kid because my mother's best friend, when she was growing up, sat directly on the ground. She caught a cold in her kidneys, and she died. So sitting directly on the ground, you know, that is just like 2 or 3 steps away from dead. Getting water in your ear, same deal. It was like this terror, a wet head. There were so many things that were like a fear, laughing during a meal, sitting too close to the TV. I remember once I had this like sort of expandable bracelet. My mother said, take that off, it's too tight. Your hand will get gangrene and drop off. Nevertheless, my parents and I never discussed death, like their situation, when things kind of, you know, were getting kind of going on. And my parents lived independently. They're in the apartment in which I grew up until they were about 93. They were quite advanced in age, if not other ways, which we won't go into. So do you guys ever think about things? What kinds of things? You know, things. Plans. I have no idea what you guys want. Let's say something happened. Am I the only sane person here? You know what? Forget it. Never mind. Que sera, sera. Later that same day. Phew. 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 We all like, you know, escaped. It's a terrible conversation. I visited them for the first time in years at their apartment in Brooklyn where I grew up. What I noticed first was the level of grime. What is grime? It's not ordinary dust or a greasy stovetop that hasn't been cleaned in a week or two. It's more of a coating. It's something that happens when people haven't cleaned in a really long time. One thing my mother always told me when I was growing up was, you have to dust. If you don't, the dust gets into all the interstices of the furniture and it breaks it all apart. It was clear that she had stopped worrying about that. But what do you do if you pick up a sponge and start cleaning? Look at me. It's perfect, daughter. It will not necessarily be perceived as helpful. The person you're trying to help might even feel insulted or embarrassed. Put that down. Leave that alone. Don't touch that. Daddy and I are fine. Don't upset your mother. I wasn't great as a caretaker, and they were not great at being taken care of. By 2002, they were 90. It was hard not to notice that every time I came to see them, the grime had grown thicker, the piles of magazines, newspapers, and junk mail had grown larger, and they themselves had grown frailer. I could see that they were slowly leaving the sphere of TV commercial old age. This is like Centrum Silver, you know, when the guy is like 66 or 67 and he's kayaking. Not talking about that. And moving into a part of old age that was scarier, harder to talk about, and not a part of this culture. And here's this idiot scientist going, extend human lifespan till 140. Something was coming down the pike. It's no accident that most consumer ads are pitched to people in their 20s and 30s. For one thing, they are less likely to have gone through the transformative process of cleaning out their deceased parents' stuff. Once you go through that, you can never look at your stuff in the same way. You start to look at your stuff a little post-mortemistically. If you've lived more than two decades as a consumer, you probably have quite the accumulation, even if you're not a hoarder. An ergonomic garlic press and throw pillows and those stupid sunflower dessert plates and seven travel alarm clocks and eight nail clippers and a colander and a flat iron and three old laptops and barbells and a set of fucking bocce balls and patio furniture and an auto harp, for God's sake, and your old flute from high school and a zillion books and towels and sheets and a wok you never used. And this is a kind of conversation. I was living up in Connecticut with my family, with my children, and I would come down to Brooklyn, and I'm not really much of a driver, so this was like a real trek, and I would come out and I would visit them, and they lived deep into Brooklyn. I don't know if you know Brooklyn. There's like Brooklyn, and then there's Brooklyn, you know, where it's like a million stops on the train, and then you have to walk from the station, and it's... So, Mom, what is with this oven mitt? It's from the year one. It's disgusting. It's all burnt and cruddy, and it's got patches on it. Oh my God, these patches come from a skirt I made 40 years ago in home ec. You know, this is like where you sort of realize nothing gets thrown away. Please let me buy you a new oven mitt. He says, why waste your money? That one still works. Well, various things happen. I won't go into that here. Disasters happened, and my parents eventually came up to... assisted living place that was about 10 minutes away from me. They couldn't live on their own anymore. And my father died at 95. My mother lived for another 2 years. And those 2 years were, they were not good. I think she was very sad. She had been with him for, you know, millions and millions of years, and they'd never really been apart. And it was very, very hard. And she was, she stayed fairly sharp until the last maybe half a year or so, but physically she was starting to fall apart, and she was mostly in bed, and she slept a lot. And so here's what I used to think happened at the end. One day, old Mrs. McGillicuddy felt unwell, and she took to her bed. She stayed there for about 3 or 4 weeks, growing weaker day by day. One night, she developed something called a death rattle, and soon after that, she died. The end. Rest in peace, old Mrs. McGillicuddy. This is, you know, this is maybe like in the old movies, those black and white movies I used to watch, or Dickens or something. And maybe for some people this is how it happens, but for a lot of people, you know, the end is just so drawn out, and it can be so humiliating and painful, and it was crazy. She did pass away, and that was, and at the end of the book, my parents... cremated ashes were in my closet, and I did not know what to do with them. I would get occasionally letters from people saying, you should contact, you know, veteran services. And it was like, no, this doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know what to do with my parents' ashes. Until I figure it out, they're going to be in my closet. But anyway, this very strange thing happened that I wrote about in The New Yorker, and I'll read this. About a year and a half ago, I received an email from a woman who had read a book I wrote about my parents, a total stranger. Dear Rozchast, I read your book, but blah, 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 but there was a mystery that needed to be solved. Now, here's, I want to interject this one thing. Before, well before I was born, 42, 12 years before I was born, my parents had another child that died, baby, died shortly after birth, I think lived a day or two, and it was traumatic for them. My mother almost died. It was a horror. And the baby was buried. My parents wouldn't talk about it. Anyway, this woman reassured me that she wasn't bats, that she was merely curious. She said, but there was a mystery that needed to be solved. She reassured me that she wasn't bats, that she was merely curious about where my parents' first baby was buried. Her curiosity led her to a website called Find a Grave. This is a total stranger. There is a website called Find a Grave where she discovered something she thought I might find interesting. And sure enough, shows up. Chast, female, died December 21st, 1942, buried Mount Lebanon Cemetery in Queens. It's a Jewish cemetery in Queens. I did find it interesting. It was more information than I was able to get from my parents, so I contacted Mount Lebanon. Dear sirs or madams, blah, 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 archives, George, Elizabeth Chast, baby. The next day, I received this message. Dear Roz, I believe you have found your sister. I was way beyond flabbergasted. Not only had my sister turned up in the archives, but so had my mother's parents. This was all news to me. The man at the cemetery sent me photographs of their graves, which I included in the piece. My parents' ashes, which had been in my closet since their deaths in 2007 and 2009, had at last found a home. Several months passed. After all, there was no rush. Finally, last fall, my son and I took a subway and then a bus to Glendale, Queens, where Mount Lebanon Cemetery is. I didn't bring the cremains. It was a two-part process, and this part was mainly for paperwork. We met with the man who had found my sister and my grandparents. He showed us a book of the archived cemetery maps and the precise place where my sister was buried. He took us to her gravesite, which was unmarked, common in the case of an infant's death. My son and I put stones on her grave. Jews don't put flowers on graves, just stones. He showed us the niche wall where my parents' cremains would be housed. And he's saying to me, it overlooks where your sister is buried. It's the only one left in that wall. It's niche J2. J2, the apartment where my parents had lived for almost 50 years, where I grew up, was 2J. The other day, I returned to Mount Lebanon, this time with a pal and my parents' cremains. And there's a little photograph of me. I'm on the subway platform with this heavy blue bag. I was tempted to say to my fellow L train passengers, guess what or who is in this bag? A workman drove me out to the niche wall. I carried the bag on my lap. We were joined by a group of workmen at the wall. One of them climbed the ladder, opened the niche, and one by one placed my parents' ashes inside. Then he resealed it and climbed back down. It was time to say goodbye. And this is me with them. And I kind of like this picture. It makes me laugh in a way because this is 1960 and yet my parents are dressed like it's 1938. which is, I think, the last time they actually like looked at like what other people were wearing. This is the very first cartoon I ever had published in The New Yorker, and I have to tell you that it was a big surprise to me because I never really thought that I was going to be a cartoonist for The New Yorker. My dream goal was to be a cartoonist for The Village Voice, and I was starting to sell things to The Village Voice and also to the National Lampoon. And this was probably, but one day I decided my parents subscribed to The New Yorker. I knew they used cartoons. And I thought, well, you know, I'll try it out. They won't take anything. I don't fit in there because this was 1978. But I might as well check it out. So I took everything I had, which was about 60 cartoons, and I put it in some portfolio. I didn't really know what I was doing exactly, but I kind of called them up and, you know, what day do I drop stuff off? They said it was a Wednesday. And the next week, I went back to pick it up, and there was a note from the art editor saying that they were buying this cartoon, and I was absolutely flabbergasted that A, they were buying a cartoon at all, and B, that this is the one that they were buying. Because out of all of them, this was probably the most personal, the most obscure, the weirdest. And it, you know, people said, well, what does it mean? And for me, it's a kind of like, when I'm sitting at my desk and I'm trying to make myself laugh, and it's just like I'm making up little shapes and giving them names, and they're just nonsense, and it's like sounds that make me, I mean, maybe you guys don't do this. I mean, you know, if you had a friend when you were in, like, you know, fifth grade or something, and it was like some horrible lesson about, like, I don't know, like DeSoto discovering some continent or something, and it was very boring, and you just like drew a little hackab and you passed it to them, and you wanted to like make them laugh, and you just make up stuff. So this is really all that is. It's just like trying to make like a friend kind of laugh. And when they started running my stuff in the New Yorker, though, I didn't know this. Lee Lorenz told me later that some of the old guys were so upset that one of them asked if he owed my family money. This is another very early cartoon, Radiator Cookery. At this point in my life, I was living in Manhattan on the Upper West Side, in this apartment, which was it was a very beloved apartment, but it had no stove. I cooked on a hot plate, but it also had this incredibly hot radiator. So, this is also from that time when I was first living in New York. You are now leaving New York City's gravitational field, and this is a very early one. And I kind of like this cartoon. I have a soft spot for this cartoon because this is a mailbox, the Cranes, 1,022,796 West 79th Street. And I'll tell you a little bit about this cartoon. When you go in back in the days when people went in person to see the art editor before computers and everything, we would go in person, and you'd bring in your batch, you know, your sketches, and you know, your little group. And then you'd come back the next week, and if you had sold a cartoon, Lee Lorenz would take, he had a little folder on his desk, and he would take out the cartoon, and he'd say, we're going to buy this cartoon. And so he pulled out the sketch for this one, and he pointed to the mailbox, and I had the flag on the side. I had it, like, sticking out. It was, like, attached to the front, the door, and sticking out, like, perpendicularly. And he said, I just have to ask you, like, what is that? And I said, that's the handle. And he looked at me like I was nuts. And then he realized I'd never had a mailbox like this. You know, I only had lived in apartment houses. And he redrew the mailbox, and he explained the mechanics of a suburban mailbox. And, like, I don't want to show off or anything, but, like, I have one of these now. And, like, I know I just flipped that flag up like I've done it my whole life. And but every time I flip up the flag, I think, now I know, you know, this is, like, really great. And this is a picture of me. I'm in Brooklyn, and I'm not 40 years old. I am 11. It's clear I don't speak very good English. I have just come off boat. I don't know what boat or what country, but I am foreign in this land. And that brings me to this new book that I wrote called Going Into Town, A Love Letter to New York, because I do feel that New York in many ways really did save my life. And when I say New York, I mean Manhattan. Because when I was growing up, Brooklyn was not the sort of hipster destination that it is for a lot of young people now. And I love that. But first of all, I mean, one thing about that is that Brooklyn is so, so big that the area that has been hipsterized is actually pretty small. But when I was a kid, New York was Manhattan. And it was very much the shining city on the hill. This is the photo that picture was based on. And this is me with my mother. I'm at the the subway station in Brooklyn where we would go into town. And that's what my parents called it, going into town. A lot of people called it going into the city, but my parents called it going into town. And I don't know how many sweaters I'm wearing under that coat. I'm guessing like six, possibly. Five or six. I mean, I look so puzzled. My mother looks normal. I look like, what is why my arm does not go down? Why my head feel weird? What is happening? Why I wear these pants? I don't know. So you might ask, like, if you love New York so much, why did you leave? Well, this is why. And it gives you a little bit of background about the book. When our son was almost three, and I was pregnant with we had moved. My husband and I had moved from the Upper West Side in Manhattan. When my son was born, we moved to Park Slope, a neighborhood in Brooklyn. And then before my daughter was born in 1990, we left. We left for Connecticut. When our son was almost three and I was pregnant with our second child, my husband, our son, and I left Brooklyn for a pretty leafy suburb about an hour north of Manhattan. There are five main reasons for this leap into the unknown. One, this was 1990, the middle of the crack epidemic. We'd had it with the crime, the crack vials all over the sidewalk, all of it. Here he is, he's going, Mommy, what that? I eat that. Two, free, excellent public schools where we were going. Three, my parents lived in Brooklyn. For some people, this would have been a plus, but I had mixed feelings. Four, when you grow up in a place, sometimes you need to get away. I saw Brooklyn differently from people who came there from Wisconsin or wherever. Behind every cute organic food store, I saw the ghost of a sad, dark, odoriferous gross red of my childhood. There was nothing there for me. Five, but the main reason was this. We couldn't afford the space we needed. The four-bedroom house we bought in suburbia cost less than a crappy two-bedroom walk-up in Brooklyn, even in 1990. The decision to leave the city was terrifying. And this is my fantasy of what it would be like. My son is going, must play soccer. Need mall now. Lawn, extremely important. And this is me, hell with art. Collect thimbles instead. I didn't know how to drive. I didn't like the idea of living directly on top of a boiler or a furnace or whatever the hell was in a house basement. I still don't. I do not like that. I'd never lived in what my parents called the country. Also, would we turn into Philistines or zombies? And this is me standing on our front lawn. It's like, I own this tree. This makes no sense to me at all. So I took the kids into the city with me a lot when they were young. And this is, on one of our trips, my daughter pointed to the fire escapes, and she actually said, Mom, what are all those West Side Story things? Which I loved, because I don't know how she was familiar with that graphic of, you know, of the fire escapes. She knew the graphic, but she had no idea what it was, which is really odd. But anyway, she really did say that. As our kids were growing up, I frequently took them into the city. I wanted them to share my love for my hometown. But about a week before my daughter left for college in Manhattan, I decided to check up on her sense of logistics. And here's what happened. Well, first of all, we were having this conversation, and I was telling her, "It's Manhattan is very easy to understand for the most part. It's laid out like a grid." And she said, "What do you mean?" So I got a piece of paper and I drew, like, okay, here's the avenues, here's the streets, and so if you want to go from 52nd to 55th Street, you walk three blocks uptown. And she said to me, what's a block? And then my head spun around on my neck, and I made her a booklet. Which she could take with her. And it's Nina's basic New York City book, focusing on the borough of Manhattan, because that's where her school was, on 23rd Street. And it had a lot of little drawings in it and sort of cartoons. It was, I scotch tape a subway map in there. And basically it was about this kind of system. These are the avenues. These are the streets. These are the most important cross streets. This is why you need to know what the cross streets are. These are the east side trains. These are the west side trains. This is Central Park. This is the address. This is Fifth Avenue divides the east side from the west side. You know what uptown was, what downtown was. You know, you need to get a metro card. Here's how to hail a taxi. Just the basicest stuff. And I think it was like, first I wanted her to be safe, but also I love New York so much, and I felt, when I gave her that book, I had this hope that if she had the right tools for getting around the city, and of course some luck, because one always needs luck, especially in New York, she would fall in love with the city the way I did when I was just a few years older than her. I wanted to introduce her to Manhattan, and I didn't want them to get off on the wrong foot. So, we have to play nice. But as I was writing this book, I realized it couldn't just be this guidebook. It's a guidebook, but it was also kind of a love letter and a thank you letter, because I do feel that, as I said in the book, that I felt until I got my apartment in Manhattan, I felt like my life was really going to be, I have a little bit of a potty mouth, so brace yourself. I thought it was really going to be a shit show. I mean, I really thought, like, I'm heading for disaster here. I am really, I don't exactly know why. I can't seem to get anything right. The people I want to be friends with obviously don't want to be friends with me. The people I don't want to be friends with, then I could not get it. It was just, I went to art school. That didn't work. I mean, I did graduate, but I wasn't happy. No, it wasn't until I moved to Manhattan that things started to sort of fall into place, and I don't know why that was. I still don't really understand it, but it was like a reset. And so it's this kind of, I wanted this feeling, this like gratitude also to come through in the book, as well as this kind of guide stuff. But anyway, so other things, and weird stuff that I love about Manhattan. Like, even though this is kind of creepy, I actually kind of like it. The sidewalk in New York is like a thin shell covering a vast honeycomb of pipes and tunnels. The ground under which you are walking has been almost completely excavated. It is best if you don't think about this. I mean, it is just nuts. If you have ever seen like a construction site and then seen like a cutaway view, it's like, I wish I didn't know that. But this is the other thing I love about New York. For some reason, I've always preferred cities to nature. I am interested in the person made. I like to watch and eavesdrop on people, and I really like density of visual information. And New York, I mean, every city has its unique charms. I don't know Los Angeles at all. I'm sure that there are people here who love it, who feel the same way about it that I feel about New York. This is not about like how New York is better than every other city. It's more like, this is my favorite city. But everybody finds their own place where they just love it. But New York is unique in this one way, in that it is very compact. It is so dense because it's small, you know? I mean, it can't spread out. So you have this crazy density where you just pick, and it's still like that, you know? I mean, it's changed, yeah. You know, they've just packed in more fancy condos, but you still walk down some street in Midtown, it's like Acme first, ice skating supplies, air conditioner repair, ventriloquism school, purseteria, wigs, vitamins, buttons, brass polishers union, smoothies, dresses, cheese house, snaps and more, walk-in clinic, chess boards. It's just a mishmash of architectural styles, of eras, of stuff falling apart, brand new, you know, some fancy condos that cost like $20 million, and then like three stores away is like some like crappy like dry cleaner and like, you know, deli that's with like, you know, horrible like $2.99 like sandwiches or whatever. So, you know, it's just such a mishmash of stuff. The more nondescript your street is, the greater chance you have of making your own discoveries. And, you know, you'll just be walking down a street and it's suddenly like, this store, you know, you'll be in like a nothing street, and this is not like a brand new store. This is an ancient store. So some ribbons are new, some are like maybe like 10 years old, and some are like way older than that. And it's like, this store sells 90 jabillion kinds of ribbon, and I don't want ribbon. I don't even like ribbon that much, but it just makes me happy to look at it, you know? And then it's just like, then there's this stuff on the street. I mean, for me, this is like nature. When I discover a new variety of standpipe, I'm like, it's like discovering a new plant, you know? And they're very anthropomorphic to me. Like the one on the left, this is like, I think of her as Trixie. She's very saucy. And I think she might be a little into S&M. And then there's like this, like, you know, this guy in the upper right, he's like, nobody will see me when I sneak through these railings. And then these two in the lower right, they're like an old married couple. And they just had a fight. And she is like, I am not talking to you. Forget it. Forget about it. I'm not talking to you. And he's like, what did I do? And what is this? I mean, this doesn't even make any sense, you know? It's just insane. But this is nuts. This is like the god of all standpipes. I mean, it's like a standpipe has been bred with like some like Hindu goddess with like, you know, eight arms or something. It's just nuts looking. So that, you know, that I find that very delightful. If Manhattan had an official tree, it would be this one. You know, when I was growing up outside of our window, there was this tree that had that like rubber sort of thing. Or I guess the trees in New York, some of them are kind of, they're not really that sturdy, so they have like crutches on their side. I don't even know what these things are. They're like to help hold them up or something. It's so sad. But then also, like when you're in the city, when I'm in the city, I always overhear or see these like strange situations. So this was, and again, I think this is a factor of the density. So this was pre-Sephora. This was when there were like these kind of odd off-brand cosmetic stores. So this is like Midtown. It's about 10:15 in the morning, and I walk in, and this woman says, "Hi, can I help you?" And I say, "Yeah, I'm looking for a new lipstick." And she pulls out this lipstick, and she said, "You should try our special line. Put it on in the morning, and it never comes off." And then she leans over me, and she goes, "Look, I just ate a salad." And I'm thinking, like, who eats a salad at, like, 10:15 in the morning? That is, like disgusting. And this is a crazy story. And I'm going to read it to you. It's a little bit long, but the story is The Knife. A couple of weeks ago, on a night of unseasonable warmth, I was walking in the city. I was still getting used to the early darkness. Mostly, I liked it. It made the day shorter. Yes, almost time for bed. The streets were jammed with people leaving work, students coming home from classes, tourists dragging suitcases, etc. I like to look at people, but in that sly, indirect way that people look at other people in the city. I was trained as a child growing up in the city to never, ever look a stranger in the eye because they could be a nut. I look away, I look at a building, another glance at the person, at the parking meter, at the ground, back at the person. My husband, who's from the Midwest, finds this peculiar, and he says, "People are nice." And I say, "Yeah, maybe." Anyway, on this particular evening, as I was walking and looking and pretending not to look, something on the sidewalk caught my eye. It was a large chef's knife, sheathed in white cardboard. It looked as if it had been newly purchased and accidentally dropped. I picked it up and put it in my bag. Not every day one finds a chef's knife, I thought, and then I completely forgot about it. I kept walking, I wasn't tired, and the city was filled with wonderful distractions. I met my daughter for dinner at an Italian restaurant. We ate and drank and yakked for a long time. It was such a nice night that after dinner we started walking uptown. I just had a brainstorm. Let's go to the top of the Empire State Building. And she says, okay. I hadn't been up there in 30 years. My daughter had never been. Sometimes it's actually fun to do a touristy thing. There certainly had been some changes since then. So there's like security. I had completely, and suddenly there's like all these like guards standing around my bag. And one of them says, "Ma'am, do you have a knife in your bag?" And I'm saying, "Yeah, well, there's a teeny tiny one on my keychain." And he pulls out the chef's knife. My explanation didn't really help. "Well, you see, I found it walking along, found it on the sidewalk. Daughter and I, you know when you get nervous, like when somebody asks an authority and like you start like giving way too much information, and we had dinner, and then I completely forgot, and here we are." And they believed me, but they confiscated it, and they said I could reclaim it when we came back down from the observation deck. I never bothered. Out of the ether it came, and back into the ether it went. And this is about, like, going to the museums. And, like, I love the Metropolitan Museum, so I have a section in the book about I love to go and make up stories. This is my favorite era in art. It's probably, like, the very early Renaissance when they have some of the rules of perspective, but not all of them. And sometimes, like, there's strange things happen where there's a painting and there's, like, this floating house. And I like to make up the story. So it's like, oh, wise men, forgive me for making your house levitate. Perhaps you didn't mean to, but still you must be punished. They're going, oh, goody. And then there's things like this, the Bristnick sisters. And I love this. I love the expressions on these two ladies in this painting. And the pretty one is holding out this bunch of herbs, and the other one is looking at the viewer. And so the pretty one is saying, poor Marcia, not much in the looks department. Maybe these magical herbs will help. And the one looking at us is saying, you guys are listening to this dimwit, right? And this one is called Put Something On. Put this on. You can't go around naked. No. Put it on. No. Put it on, damn it. Bite me. Or get fashion tips. Next time you get your hair cut, ask for a Zazera. This was the in style in late 15th century Venice. I mean, it's just great. It's like this little sort of weird helmet. But maybe the best thing about the Met is that even at the height of the tourist season, what some people call the holidays, when Manhattan can seem just a tad too crowded, you can always find a place to be alone. It's like, just go see the Etruscan vases. I swear to God, nobody will be there. They're so beautiful. One of the most pleasant things about Manhattan, as opposed to, say, Death Valley, is the unlikelihood that you will run out of food or water. My father used to carry a little bit of food with him when he went into town, a banana, a wax paper bag with a piece of honey cake in it, a plastic bag containing a stack of graham crackers. At some point, he'd announced to my mother, Elizabeth, I feel like chewing on something. And then out would come the honey cake or whatever. My mother hated when he used that expression, chewing on something, but he used it all the time anyway. And then I have some stuff about food. I'm going to go through a little bit faster just because we're running to the end here. But in Manhattan, every food, ethnicity, preference, aversion, allergy, craving, fad, or combination of the above is represented. If you can't find what you want to eat here, maybe you don't like food. And I guess one of the things that's fun is, again, it's that compression and that density where you just, everything will be smashed together. There are pros and cons to apartment life. When I was a kid, my mother used to keep a crutch handy. So when the horrible upstairs neighbors who had clearly never lived in an apartment house before started riding their horses or whatever they were doing, she could bang on the ceiling with it. Didn't always work. When you live in an apartment building, you have no control over who your neighbors might be. I didn't know this guy, but I'll never forget my glimpse of his apartment. And this is my old building in the West 70s and mid-1980s, and the people are the building handyman and me. And here the handyman, I knew him a little bit, and he said, do you want to see something kind of weird? And I say, okay. He opened the door to an apartment stacked from floor to ceiling with newspapers. Floor to ceiling. There was a narrow path that snaked around. I saw an arm of a chair peeking out. It's a miracle that the apartment hadn't collapsed into the apartment below. Apparently the guy had died a few days before standing up. Yeah. In 1949... E.B. White wrote one of the best books ever written about New York City called Here is New York. In it, he wrote that there are essentially three New Yorks. First, there is the New York of the person who was born here, who takes the city for granted and accepts its size and its turbulence as natural and inevitable. Secondly, there is the New York of the daily commuter who arrives for work every morning and leaves every evening for home in the suburbs. You will almost never see this New Yorker wandering around aimlessly or sitting on a park bench. The commuter gives New York its tidal restlessness. Last of all is the New York of the person who was born somewhere else and came to New York in quest of something. And I love this description so much, partly because I feel it is so accurate, and I feel that I have been and I am a member of all three groups. I mean, I was born there, and so, yeah, you know, there's a lot about it that feels very natural to me, more natural than being out in a place where there's nobody, which I always freaks me out. It makes my husband laugh. You know, we'll be like driving someplace and say, "It's so dark," and he just cracks up. He said, "Yeah, it's night," you know. And then the commuter, I mean, I'm not really a daily commuter, but I have definitely taken that commuter train quite often, especially, you know, when my kids were growing up. And there's also the person who comes to New York, Manhattan, in quest of something, and that would definitely describe me, you know, leaving Brooklyn and wanting something besides what life seemed to offer in Brooklyn. I think... For me, Brooklyn was a place of very limited horizons where it was sort of, I almost felt it was sort of like pummeled into you. Do not have big dreams because you won't get that. You'll be disappointed. You should just get a job. And then, you know, if you have time for a hobby, like do that. But like don't, you know, this is life. Sort of sucks, and you better get used to it. And, I mean, I still remember my uncle saying to me, "So you think the world owes you a living?" You know, that kind of thing, which I think maybe is sort of typical of a certain generation. But, you know, moving to Manhattan and wanting to make my living as a cartoonist was a sort of, like, leap, you know, leap of faith. And I feel like that's what people who move to Los Angeles, you know, for a lot of people, it's that same thing, or people who move to Paris, or people who move to any big city. For me, it was the leap from Brooklyn into Manhattan. Back to cartoons, and then we'll close out here. This is Nancy Drew Mysteries, The Later Years. Nancy Drew and the Missing House Keys. I know, I left them right here. Nancy Drew and the Mystery of the 8 pounds. How did I gain 8 pounds? I eat nothing. Nancy Drew and the Secret of the Computer. You and I are going to be great friends. And I think of this. This is an obit man. I don't know if you guys ever read the obituary pages. Yeah. This is dousing for coffee. The Holy Trinity. I get involved in these like weird obsessive hobbies sometimes. I got very obsessed with Pysanky eggs for a while. And these are, you draw on, they're not painted, they are, you draw on, they're like batik. You draw on the egg, they're just regular chicken eggs. You draw on the egg with wax, and then you dip them in dye, and where the wax is, the dye doesn't go. So you're thinking in the negative, which comes very easily to me. And I made hundreds of them. I got completely obsessed. It turns out that Charles Adams had also, not Pysanky eggs, but he liked, there's something about drawing on an egg, which is very satisfying. It's very fun. There's nothing else quite like it. I also got obsessed with rug hooking. This has nothing to do with those latch hook kits. This is a primitive rug hooking, it's called, and it's what, I don't know, those pioneer ladies used to do or something. I don't know, never mind. This is also a rug that I made. This is my father at breakfast. He loved to take everything out of the refrigerator, which would drive my mother insane. Because he didn't know, would he want chav, would he want borscht? So you have to take them both out. Maybe you want to like mix the two. He loved to just make these weird kind of combos. This rug is about 4 by 5 feet. It just took forever. It was ridiculous. My latest obsession is now embroidery. And this is one of my favorite quotes. It's from the Polish poet, Czesław Miłosz. When a writer is born into a family, the family is finished. And I wound up doing an embroidery cover for the New Yorker last May. It was really very crazy. This is actually, somebody asked me if it was an app, and no, it was embroidered on a piece of muslin. You can sort of see the graphics person left a little piece of the muslin so you could see it's actually embroidered, and. It was also the tech issue, so it's a motherboard. And please do not ever try to build anything from this motherboard, because it's just, I just sort of picked the, like, my favorite decorative elements from, like, several motherboards and combined them. And this I wanted to just show you because it's fun. I made a mural for the Museum of the City of New York, and it took 18 hours, and I'm going to show it to you. It's a little compressed here. I'm not going to put it on for 18 hours. We're not Andy Warhol here. I did it over 3 days. It was really nuts. You know how, like, I mean, you'll see, like, how big, it's 10 by 15 feet. You know how sometimes, like, you agree to do a project, like, months in advance, because you think, oh, that's months away. And then when it actually comes time to do, you think, like, I'm nuts. Why did I agree to do this? I mean, this is, so, but anyway, it worked out. and closing out here, this is the vain but realistic queen. Mirror, mirror on the wall. Who, if she lost 10 pounds and had her eyes and her neck done and had the right haircut, couldn't her age group be the fairest one of all? and this is just... And... that's it. So I think we're going to... Thanks. Thank you. I think we're going to do some questions.
I have a question over here.
Okay. Oh, yeah, sure. Okay.
I have a songwriter question. Which comes first, the music or the lyrics? And you kind of referred to it, your daughter said that. You're hurting me, and then the cartoon came. How often is that the process?
I would say 90-something percent of the time, it's the words. But every once in a while, I'm doodling, and something will come. Like the end is near guy, I just wanted to draw one of those guys, and I did. And then I realized, oh, he needs a wife. so occasionally it happens the other way around.
When you would go in person to turn in your cartoons, would you ever get to spend time with the other cartoonists? Is something you want to? Because when you see comedians and you know they're funny on stage, and then you see them later on a talk show and they're not that funny, I was wondering, the other cartoonists at the New Yorker, did you get to have a lot of interaction with them, and were they as funny as their cartoons are?
It really varied from person to person. I mean, some people were absolutely, you know, not that funny in person, and then some people were just absolutely hilarious. So it really varied from person to person. When I went in person back in the 80s, I did socialize with other cartoonists, but it's not the same anymore. I don't think they do that so much.
Earlier you had Charles Adams reference, and I know the two great cartoonists of my lifetime, my childhood, my parents worried about me because of my obsession with Charles Adams. So it was Charles Adams and then you. So there must be a connection. I didn't think about that till now, but were you a Charles Adams nut?
I was a Charles Adams nut. He was my first cartoon love. I mean, I discovered him when I was about 8 or 9 years old. My parents were in the school system in New York, and they would get, you know, July and August off, and the whole group of Brooklyn school teachers, we would go up to Cornell University. I don't know, somebody started it, and so then they all went, and we would rent student housing. And my parents would go to lectures sometimes at Cornell, and they would park me. There was a browsing library, and there was one section of the browsing library were cartoon books, and in that section I discovered Charles Adams, and, you know, Black Mariah, Drawn and Quartered, Monster Rally, Adams and Evil. I mean, I would just sit there and I could look at them over and over and over again, just loved them so much. So yeah, you had good taste.
So I loved every second of this. I'm a New Yorker. I'm 10 years out. I'm 10 years here. And I wanted to get your take on, you know, New York right now. I feel like, you know, New Yorkers always have a take on, you know, the New York of their youth was the New York they love and miss. And I'm disturbed by how increasingly inaccessible it is for, you know, the person who shows up with just like a suitcase and a dream, you know. So I would love to know what your take on New York right now is.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not really a nostalgic person. I don't think that's my nature. And I loved the New York of my youth, but I remember talking to one of the older cartoonists, and he was like, we were walking in Midtown someplace, and he was saying, yeah, New York's not the same. When I came to New York in my 20s, and I remember thinking, like, that's really weird because this seems so great to me right now. And so I think sometimes when people get like really nostalgic about the old New York, what they're nostalgic for is their life when they were in their 20s, you know? So I think New York is still amazing and great. And yes, it has changed. There are more of those, like, to me, they seem kind of almost empty condos where, as far as I understand it, they seem to be built for foreign people, you know, who have like robbed their countries to like park their money, you know, because it doesn't seem like anybody really lives there. But I don't know. I try not to get too depressed about it or too nostalgic. And also, I remember how disgusting it was. I mean, I remember, you know, how friends of mine were routinely mugged. I know so many people who were held up at gunpoint or knife point. The dog poop all over the sidewalk, just how dirty it was. And I'm really not nostalgic for that, you know? And also, I think for some people, you know, coming to the East Village and Alphabet City, like if they were coming, I was talking to somebody today who said that they had lived there in the 80s, and it was like they were coming from the suburbs. To them, like, that was the romance of the city, was the grit and the grime. I grew up with disgustingness, you know? I didn't live in, like, a slum, but the idea of living in a place that was worse than when I grew up, where I grew up, was not that as appealing to me, you know, as it might have been for somebody who grew up with, like, a lawn and, like, you know, that kind of mailbox, you know? So, I don't know. I think a person can still come there. And they probably live in Brooklyn, but that's all right. You know, or even Queens, maybe. And there's great places in Queens. So,
Well, it's not very affordable anymore. I wish I could have back my apartment that I sold in 97, but I can't afford it now. Uh-huh. But here's my question. My favorite cartoon of yours, it makes me laugh out loud every time, is The Party After You Left.
Oh.
And my question is... I remember seeing it in the magazine at first, and then it came out as a book. And then what happened was the cartoon from the magazine got extended to the back cover so that it was twice as wide and there was twice the content. Okay. How did you go about that process of reinventing it, and was that hard?
I can't remember. I mean, it was... I don't remember. I think it was... probably, you know, a little mix of hard and also fun. Oh, good, good. I'm glad.
You have a new editor.
Yes.
And does that change things for you?
Knock on something. It's still okay. I mean, I started out with William Shawn, then Bob Gottlieb, Tina Brown, and David Remnick, so four different editors-in-chief, and there's been Lee Lorenz, Bob Mankoff, and now Emma Allen, who's the new cartoon editor. Yes and no. I mean, not really. It's still the same process. It's still hard, you know, coming up with ideas and actually making myself sit down and realizing that nothing gets done unless I actually sit down and sit at my desk and get into that frame of mind. So... in some ways, it doesn't really matter. There's a person here.
Yeah. Is is George Booth an influence on you? Is he one of your favorites?
Oh, I love George Booth. He is, in some ways he is, because, I mean, one thing about George Booth and one thing about the cartoonists that I love the most is that they have these, it's not just a gag with, like, you know, anybody can draw it. It's like the drawing has so much to do with the joke. The two are so intertwined. And he has such a recognizable, it's not just the style, it's the world that he creates, you know, and it's the George Booth world. And, you know, Charles Adams had that world, and Ed Koren had that world, and Helen Hokanson had that world, and Mary Petty had that world. And so that's my favorite sort of cartoon, when, you know, the gag is you're only seeing like a brief second of this whole parallel world, you know. So yeah, he's one of my favorites, but not more than Charles Adams.
Okay. So I've been a fan of your work forever, and this is the first time I've been in the same room with you, and you're so much more lighthearted than I imagined you would be.
And you don't see me when I'm not on stage.
Okay, right. I'm sure, yes, that has something to do with
there's
it.
That.
And you make me laugh more than anybody except my husband. I think you're like his only competition when he hears me laughing. He knows that I'm reading your work. I was just wondering, in elementary school, were you like outgoing, the class clown? Were you shy?
All through school, I was... paranoid and hostile.
Yes. No wonder I like you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So anyway, thank you very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. Seven.